regarding Shmuel Hanavi is dedicated by Dr. and Mrs. Arthur Small in loving memory of Nochum Eliyahu ben Meir Alevi and Chana Bas Aaron Mordechai. Tonight's lecture is about two of the most fascinating people in the Tanakh and Jewish history. Shmuel Hanavi, the prophet Samuel, and Shaul HaMelech, King Saul. Shmuel marks the last of the judges, the end of the period of the judges, and Shaul marks the first of the monarchs, the first of the kings of Israel. And their lives are intertwined and blended together. There is a third person in this story, and that third person is King David, David HaMelech, whom I will discuss, God willing, next time. But the story tonight will be basically that of Shaul and of Shmuel. Now, basic to our understanding of the story is that it takes 400 years from the time the Jewish people come to the land of Canaan, to the land of Palestine, to the land of Israel, until the time when they finally become established under a central government, finally gain full control over their land, and have the ability to think about building the temple and establishing themselves in the framework and pattern that the Torah predicted for them. 400 years. I only say that so that we have a little perspective on time in our time. We are by nature impatient, and because of the fact that a human being's life is limited, so 400 years is a very, very long time. But in history, especially in Jewish history, 400 years is not that long a period of time. And because of that, therefore, many of the events that take place in our time regarding the land of Israel and the people of Israel, the government of Israel, the problems that are faced, the difficulties that are encountered, all have to be seen again in that backdrop of time. God, Kaviyochel, doesn't run out of time. He has patience. He sees things over the long run. And it may take sometimes hundreds of years for the moment to gel, for the moment to occur and have meaning. And that is the backdrop to this story of Shmuel and of Shaul, because of the fact that the prophets and the judges had preceded them, and all of a sudden Shmuel Hanavi is the one that brings it to its proper summation. The prophet Samuel is born miraculously. We read the story of his birth in the Haftorah of the first day of Rosh Hashanah. His mother Chana was one of the barren women who under natural and ordinary and normal circumstances could not give birth to a child. She was infertile. And she comes to Shiloh, and there in the presence of the last judge of Israel, Eli, who is also the high priest of Israel, she prays to God, but she prays to God silently and weepingly and emotionally, in such a way that Eli suspects her of being inebriated, drunk. And he chastises her for her behavior in the temple of God. And she answers him that you have mistaken me. You don't see me correctly. I am not a woman that has drunk anything. I am not a woman that that behaves improperly. But I'm a woman that is saddened by my lot in life, over the fact that I do not have a future. Her husband has two wives, so her competition, so to speak, Penina, has children, and even though her husband loves her dearly, she feels empty, she feels unfulfilled. And Eli gives her a blessing, and the blessing is heard, so to speak, by God, and is translated into the son Shmuel. And when Shmuel is born, so the Talmud tells us many interesting insights about Shmuel. One insight was that he was a Nazir. He himself was a Nazirite in terms that he never drank wine nor cut his hair his entire life. He was a Nazir as Shimshon was a Nazir. And that could be understood in the light of the fact that Eli accused her of being a drunkard, and she therefore made the commitment that not only was she not a drunkard, but that no one would drink wine. And Shmuel was raised as a Nazir, and all of his life he was a Nazir. When Shmuel is 3 years old, when he is weaned from his mother, so even though he was of sickly health, like all the little Jewish boys, and he always had a cold and problems, his mother brings him, the Talmud says that that's why she didn't bring him earlier, because simply he could not withstand the rigors of the trip. She brings him to the temple at Shiloh, she brings him to the Mishkan, and she gives him over to the care, she entrusts him to Eli. Eli's an old man, Eli is in his 70s. And he's the young child who's 3 years old. But Eli raises him. Eli is really his father. He's his spiritual father. He's his physical father. And Eli is his Rebbe. And Eli is the one that sees that the child is blessed by God and that he possesses the gift of prophecy. And the Tanakh describes it to us early on that Shmuel hears Kaviyochel, so to speak, the voice of God, and Eli does not. And Eli is aware of it. Eli is aware of the special gifts of the child. And he raises him to this position of leadership. He raises him to be his successor. And what Eli could not have from his own sons, as I mentioned to you before, his sons Hophni and Pinchas did not turn out as Eli would have wished, and they were unable to succeed him. He has from his surrogate son, he has from Shmuel, who does succeed him, and through him Eli lives, because of the fact that Shmuel is the heir to all of the greatness and all the tradition of Eli. Shmuel's a Levi, and he, the Talmud tells us he was a person of independent wealth, and because of that, we see that throughout his service to the Jewish people, he never took any money, he never was paid a salary, he never took any expenses. At the end of his service, when he speaks to the Jewish people in his farewell address, so he mimics the message of Moshe. Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I used? Where have I ever taken any public funds for what I have done? If anybody ever says, if anybody can say, hey, Shmuel took something, he was paid, let him stand now, I will give accounting. Well, the ability to do that cannot be underestimated. It's one of the great failings, I feel, of the modern, and it's not so modern, it's almost 800 years, 700 years that rabbis receive salaries in the Jewish world. But it's one of the failings of the system is the fact that we don't have independently wealthy rabbis. And because the rabbi would be better off and the community would be better off and the system would work differently. But not everybody can be barrel wine. And that's just the way the world works. So we have to take it the way it is. But Shmuel was a very wealthy man. Shmuel had wealth. And Shmuel, therefore, all the years of his life, even though all of his life was dedicated to public service and all of his life was devoted to the public service of the Jewish people, and to a great extent, he had no private life whatsoever from the time he was 3 years old on. He dies at the age of 52. even though he has all his entire life is bound up in public life, he is never on the public payroll, he never takes any public money, he doesn't need it. And therefore his authority in his greatness is unquestioned. Some of the other judges whom I've discussed with you over the past few lectures were not people of means. And therefore, because they were not people of means, they were suspected always. The nature of the public and the nature of the Jewish public especially is not always to be charitable in its outlook towards its leadership. And to suspect people sometimes unfairly of wrong motives. But here Shmuel is blessed with the fact that he has this wealth and he need not come to anyone else for aid. He doesn't have to accept money. Shmuel was the judge for 10 years. In other words, from the age of 42 to the age of, I'm sorry, from the age of 39 to the age of 49. And then 1 year he and Shoal served together. And then for 2 years Shoal was the judge, was the king, and Shmuel dies in the second year of Shoal's reign. And Shoal will die 3 months after the death of Shmuel. So for 36 years he is under the shadow of Eliyet. And this is a very, very difficult and sad and terrible time for the Jewish people. The Philistines have destroyed the Mishkan and Shiloh. They have captured the Holy Ark. They have done terrible things, and the Jewish people are powerless. They are unable to withstand the Philistines. They're unable to capture them. And the Philistines have a new hero, the great Goliath, the giant. He's the secret weapon. And the Jewish people are demoralized. They're demoralized because of their political and military problems. They also suffer from internal problems. It goes hand in hand. The enemy alone cannot defeat you. And there has to be inner problems as well. And they had inner problems, strong inner problems in faith, in observance, in knowledge of Torah. And Shmuel is the great man that fixes it all up. He is the great leader. Now, rabbis say that Shmuel is equal to Moses and to Aaron. In one person, he's both Moshe and Aaron. He's the spiritual leader. He's the temporal leader. He's the warrior. He's the prophet, he's the great educator. He has all of these great qualities. One of the remarkable people in Jewish history. Now, the political situation, let me just mention as an aside, I mentioned to you that the Aron HaKodesh was captured from Shiloh and captured by the Philistines. But the Luchos, the tablets of stone that Moshe brought down from Sinai, were saved from the Philistines in a daring raid. And they were saved by Shoal, by the man who would become the king. That is this first act of prominence, is that Shoal, from the tribe of Benjamin, is able to reclaim the Luchos. He steals them back from the Plishtim. So eventually the Plishtim, when the Oren is returned, the Luchos were in Jewish hands. And that was saved by the king, by the man who later would become the king, by Shaul HaMelech. Shmuel is known to us as the author of the book of Shoftim and the book of Rus and partially of the book of Shmuel. And the additions of these books to the holy canon. So you have the five books of Moshe, which were written by Moshe, and then the book of Yoshua, written by Yoshua. Shmuel is the next author in the list. He's the one, the books of Shoftim, and of Rus, the Megillah of Rus, and the book of Shmuel itself. Now the second half of the book of Shmuel, or the latter part of the book of Shmuel, after Shmuel's death, was finished by the prophet God, who lived during the time of David, and he is the one who completed the book of Shmuel. Shmuel instituted the following reforms, if I could say that word, in the Jewish people. First of all, he was the first judge that traveled amongst the people. He did not wait for the people to come to him. You know, there's always a certain amount of presence or almost arrogance that an office of leadership requires. And the leader feels that it's demeaning many times. So, you know, he has his office, he has his place, you make an appointment, you come see him. So that's very good if people want to come and see you. People don't want to come and see you. So many a leader has stayed isolated in his castle or in his palace or in his office. Many a rabbi has done so also. He's waiting for people to come to his Beis Medrash to learn or to come. They don't come, so they don't come. That wasn't Shmuel's philosophy. Shmuel's philosophy was he went to the people. He traveled. He was a circuit rider, the first of the great circuit riders. And he made annual trips throughout Israel. And then he returned home to Ramah, where Shmuel lived. You know that there's the Arabs have a tradition. They have a village outside Jerusalem that you can see from Jerusalem called Nebi Samuel. And there, by Arab tradition, is the burial place of the prophet Shmuel. Whether that is where Shmuel is buried or not, it's hard to know. And many of the Arab villages have accurate traditions, but many of them do not have accurate traditions. And this village, we really don't know. But Shmuel's home was in that area. And Shmuel would travel all year, and he would come home, stay a few weeks, and travel again. And when he would travel, Shmuel instituted a system of education. That was his second reform. The first reform was the fact that he traveled and that he instituted courts of justice, and he brought the message of Torah to the people, and he didn't wait until the people came to him. But the second thing that he did is he instituted a system of education, schools, great schools. Now, rabbis tell us that at the time of Shmuel, the educational level of the Jewish people in Torah knowledge rose enormously. We find that this educational reform happened every number of generations within the Jewish people, and that has continued till our time. There is a strong school system, and people study Torah, and then for one reason or another it begins to decline, to decline, to decline, and it looks like it's going to fall apart, and then all of a sudden it is restructured and it becomes very strong again. And then the process sets in again, the historic process of weakening, of drifting, and then again it is made strong again. So in the time of the Tanakh, we see that in the time of Shmuel it was restored, and it lasted till the time of Shlomo, and then it went into a decline. Then at the time of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, it was reinstituted. Then it was reinstituted again at the time of Purim. And then it was reinstituted again at the time of Hashmonaim. And then it was reinstituted again at the time of Rebbe, of Rabbeinu HaKadosh. And throughout Jewish history, we see the pattern. We even see it in our time. The strengthening of Jewish education and Jewish knowledge and the variety of schools and the strong push for Jewish knowledge and Jewish education. It's almost a cyclical thing. a great deal of it is based, I think, on the insight that God made us the promise that the Torah would not depart from amongst the Jewish people. So when things get really tough, when it really looks like we're going to fall apart and there isn't going to be any Torah, so then, so to speak, God's promise kicks in. It's like an automatic fail-safe gear that exists within Jewish history. And when it reaches the nadir, when it reaches the low point, when it's almost out, so then that kicks in. And when that kicks in, then remarkable things happen in a relatively short period of time. And things happen that we could not have imagined 50, 100 years ago could ever become the reality of the situation. Well, that's what Shmuel was able to do. Shmuel's second great reform, therefore, was education. He built a public school system in terms of the Jewish people, that there was no one that was its equal until that time. In other words, from the time of Moshe until the time of Shmuel, it began to decline. Throughout all the 400 years, the time of idolatry, the time of the lack of central government, etc., so the study of Torah began to decline. It began to fall apart, that we could well understand. And by the time Shmuel came to power, it was at its low ebb, at its low point. And Shmuel was the one that was able to restore it. Shmuel was the one that was able to raise it to the level which the Talmud says really equaled the time of Moshe. He put it back to the level where it was when Moshe was still there. That's one of the reasons that he's compared to Moshe and to Aaron. Third great accomplishment of Shmuel. I'm talking about the enormous influence of a person, not only on his generations, but on all later history. Third great accomplishment was that Shmuel was the one that united the tribes again. Jewish people are terribly fractious people. We like to engage in very divisive behavior. And when you had 12 tribes that competed against each other, so then it would be very hard to form a central government. And as we have seen, from the death of Yoshua onward, there was no central government. It was Ish Kol HaYosher Bein Ovyaseh, which literally means chaos, like a shul. Right? Everybody does what he wants, and no one can tell anybody else what to do. And you have that problem that's part of the problem that exists in Jewish life today also. The independence of the Jew, the nonconformity of the Jew, makes him a very difficult person to govern and to unite. He's not willing to unite. He's not willing to be part of the whole. Shmuel's third great accomplishment was that he united the Jewish people. He united them politically, diplomatically, militarily, so that they now were one whole people. And therefore they would be willing and able to conquer the land finally, to destroy their enemies, and to build a strong central government, which was the prerogative of the time. Now Shmuel thought, and this is one of the most difficult areas in Tanakh to interpret, but Shmuel thought that he or his children would be the one that would, if not be the king, but that they would negate the necessity of there being a king. That they would raise the Jewish people to a level when it did not need a monarch. Now, the idea of monarchy, well, we in the Western world today, after our long experience with monarchy and with absolute monarchy and the divine right of kings, we are not very high on it. Very few of the kings in the history of the world have been decent people. And someone who has absolute power, so he's absolutely corrupted. It's very hard to deal with it. And we are accustomed, therefore, to democratic ideals. We're accustomed to the negation of all royalty. That's especially true in the United States, which was founded on the principle that they would not have a king. George Washington was offered to be the king, and he refused, saying that they did not fight the revolution for so many years and have so many thousands of people die in order to reinstitute monarchy. And the founding fathers, in their definition of politics, equated a king, any king, with tyranny. The mere existence of a king was tyranny. Well, the Torah, on the other hand, makes provision for a king. In fact, the Torah tells us that one of the things that the Jewish people were commanded to do was establish a king. Now, there's a difference of opinion, and that's a difference of opinion that it's hard to resolve, but there's a difference of opinion whether or not the king was seen as the lesser of two evils. In other words, one evil is the anarchy and the chaos and the divisiveness of the people, and the other evil is seen as the king, who would unite them and provide them with central government. And since the king, the true king of Israel, was a pious and God-fearing person who was subject always to the criticism and advice and input of the prophets and to the, of the Sanhedrin, so therefore such a king was controllable, malleable. He was a person that would not run away with it. So therefore that was a good thing to have. But there are commentaries that saw in the king a condescension to the weaknesses of man. If really the Jewish people would be the Jewish people, then they wouldn't need a king. But since the Jewish people, unfortunately, many times don't live up to what they should be, they're unable to maintain themselves on the plateau and level of behavior that they should, so then at least we'll give them a king with these safeguards so that they'll be able to have a government. And in the Tanakh we read of Shmuel's presentation of the idea of a king. God tells him that it's time to have a king. And Shmuel puts it to the people. In one of the great moments in Tanakh, all the Jewish people are gathered before him, hundreds of thousands of people, and he tells them that they're entitled to have a king. But in the speech that he says, he does everything possible to dissuade them from accepting the king. He describes there everything that the king will do. He'll draft you in the army, he'll raise the taxes, he'll take the men away for his work. He'll use your daughters for his maids. He describes all of the tyranny implicit in government, in a king, in royalty. And he says, and you don't need a king because God is your king. The Jewish people are above that. And the Jewish people answer, in effect, Shmuel says, and what do you need a king for? I'm here. I've gone before you. I've laid my life down for you for so many years. And look at the accomplishments that we have accomplished. And look at the level that we have attained. And look at the progress that we have made. So what do you need a king for? It's almost personal to Shmuel. And the Jewish people, in the time-honored fashion of repaying their leaders, say, no, we don't want you. We want a king. But they say it in a negative fashion. They say, we want a king because all the goyim have a king. We want to be, you know, like England, like France. We want to have the same, they have a king, we have a king. We want it the same way. And we want a flag, and we want a color guard, and we want the changing of the guard, and we want all the trappings of royalty, just like the goyim have. That's the language that they use. And that is what disturbs Shmuel more than anything else. Is the fact that if they would say, we want a king because in the Torah it says to have a king, or we want a king because it's politically better for us, or we want a king because of whatever practical and spiritual necessity they could say. So then that's one issue. But they're coming at the kingdom from the wrong angle. They're looking for a king for the wrong reason, and therefore the monarchy will not be successful. We embark now on a period of another 400 years, over 400 years of monarchy, and it's one disaster after another, with temporary exceptions. So it starts off, we'll see, Shaul, the first 2 years is terribly rocky, then it starts with David. So David and his son Shlomo, Solomon, that's the apex, that's the zenith, that's the high point of the monarchy. Already in the time of Shlomo, halfway through Shlomo, it starts going down. And then there are terrible things that happen. The kingdom splits. I'll discuss all of that with you, God willing, in the future. It all falls apart as Shmuel said it would. And the king becomes, instead of the instrument of goodness and of unity and of God's will, most of the kings of Judah and all the kings of Israel are negative characters, are the abuse of power, instead of being people who the people would identify with and feel good and feel loyal to. All of that disappears. Shmuel sees that, but he cannot change the mind of the people. Some Mephorshim say that the idea of the king is comparable to the idea of the halacha that appears in the Torah of Yifas Toar. Yifas Toar was that in war, soldiers were allowed to take a captive woman that was not Jewish and to live with her and to bring her home and to convert her and make her Jewish, even though that's not, the Torah tells you in advance that that's not the way to get married. And the Torah tells you in advance that it's not going to work and that the children will not turn out right. But Lo Dibra Torah Lo Keneged Yetzer Hara. The Torah spoke in practicality. The Torah realizes that's what happens in war. So the Torah said, well, do it at least the way the Torah says. It'll come out better than if I leave you to your own devices. You're going to do it anyway and it'll really turn out awful. So some Mephorshim say that was the idea of the king also. That in reality it's like Lo Dibra Torah Lo Keneged Yetzer Hara. The Torah only gave in, so to speak, because of the nature of the human being. The nature of the human being was that they wanted kings and they wanted monarchy and they wanted royalty. And therefore the Torah said, well, it's not a good idea, but we're going to let you do it because of the fact that if you do it our way, at least it'll have some benefit. If you don't do it our way, then it's just a disaster completely. So Shmuel is the man that introduces the monarchy to the Jewish people. He is the one that fashions it, that makes it, that brings it to fruition. And he is the one whom God appoints to anoint the king. He anoints the first two kings of Israel, Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, and his successor David HaMelech. David is also anointed by Shmuel. Now, as long as Shmuel is alive, even though Shaul is the king, and even though David has been anointed, they are under the shadow of Shmuel. There's no one that, as long as Shmuel is alive, then even though the other one is the king, Shmuel is the power. Shmuel is not afraid to tell the king, as we will see. He's not afraid to tell him anything. He's not afraid to chastise him. And even though we'll see that Shmuel is afraid for his life many times because he's doing things that are essentially disloyal to the king, to Shaul, but Shmuel is such a powerful force that he has a greater influence on Shaul than Shaul has on him. So he's the gray eminence. He is the man in the backdrop in the entire story. And even at the end of his life, when he is already dead, in the famous story that the Tanakh tells us, that Shaul HaMelech attempts to have him raised from the dead to ask him, to consult him. Because Shaul feels himself powerless without Shmuel. He feels that he has no ability to act. He is completely reliant on Shmuel, on his opinions, on his behavior, on everything that he has. Our rabbis tell us that at the end of his life, Shmuel, even though he was only 52 years old, he was his skin. He became very old. He looked very old. He lost much of his physical faculties and power. And our rabbis attributed that to three things. First of all, he didn't have any joy from his children. Children can make a person very old. And his sons, just as Shmuel was incorruptible and did not under any circumstances want or take anything for himself, his sons misused their position. They abused it, and they asked for gifts, the gifts that belonged to the Levium, etc. They asked for it, and since they were people of power, and Shmuel's sons, etc., so they took unfair advantage. People gave them. The second thing that made him old, our rabbis tell us, was the fact that he had devoted all of his life to public service, which also can make a person old. 50 years serving the Jewish people will do it. And the third thing was the disappointment of the institution of the royal household, the coming of the monarchy. So it's like all the air went out of the balloon at once, a combination of all of these events. So it says in the Tanakh, Vayhi kasher zokein Shmuel. Shmuel became very old. So our rabbis say he wasn't very old, he was only 52 when he died. Koftzol of Zikna, old age jumped on him. That's the phrase of the rabbis. You know, one day a person is strong and good and healthy, and the next day all the age has jumped upon him. And he no longer has his faculties. He's no longer able to deal with it. And that's what happened to Shmuel at the end of his life. As I mentioned, Shmuel died a number of months before Shaul. Within 3-4 months, Shaul will be dead. Now, who was Shaul? So, Shaul, in the Tanakh, there are people who in the Tanakh, we get one impression of them, and then if you see how the rabbis treated them in the Talmud or in the Medrash, you have a different impression. There are people, for instance, I discussed with you Noach. In the Chumash, Noach comes off very fine. Noach comes off complimentarily. But in the opinion of the rabbis and the Medrash, etc., they whittle Noach down a bit. They chop him down a little. They color the picture. Shaul is just the opposite. In the Tanakh, Shaul, we don't find Shaul to be a very sympathetic character. We see his weaknesses portrayed in a stark fashion. His unwanted persecution of David, his terrible jealousy, his melancholy, his moods, his violence. We don't appreciate the other side of him. So the rabbis came and they built up the other side. And they told us of the greatness of Shaul. Shaul is one of the greatest people that the Jewish people had. And that's why it says in the Tanakh, Ben Shona Shaul B'molcho. Shaul was 1 year old when he became the king. So our rabbis say that cannot be, that he was a 1-year-old baby when he became the king. But it means to commit to us the understanding that he was as free of sin, he was as innocent, as lovable, as popular as a 1-year-old child. one-year-old child is one of the nice stages in life. It's before the terrible twos. It's not an infant anymore. It's a human being, but it has all the charm and innocence and love that's inherent in a human being. So our rabbis came to say that was the description of Shaul. And Shaul was a hero. He's the man that saved the Luchos from the Plishtim. The tablets of stone had been saved. And everything about Shaul was extraordinary. Our rabbis tell us that Shaul was an extremely handsome man, and that he had apparently the outstanding feature of him was his neck, that he was very tall, Mishichma v'mala, from his shoulders and above he was tall, so some people apparently are tall from the legs. There are some people that have, they have a very high waist, they have very long legs. Shaul was tall from his shoulders up. Our rabbis say he had a tremendous neck. The Gemara in Sota says that there were people who had gifts given them from heaven, and because of those gifts, they were unable to handle it, and it turned into a negative trait instead of a positive trait. And Shaul had that strong, and the rabbis say that's why he was beheaded. His mila was his head and his neck and his shoulders, and the end of his life was that he was, after he committed suicide, the Philistines beheaded him. And they took his head on a pike and sent it around all the cities of the Philistines. And his body they hung on the walls of the city, so the Jews were able to catch his body and bring it back. But his head was captured by the Philistines. But Shaul was somebody that was so handsome and so charismatic. He had in himself such a quality. The Talmud tells us people went out of their way, women, people went out of their way to see him, just to see him, just to look at him. That he had that extraordinary characteristic. We find that a rabbi said the same thing about Yosef, that he had such a handsomeness, such a quality to him, that people went out of their way to see him. So all of this makes Saul a terribly tragic figure, because the rabbis say, here is someone that's free of sin, here's a good person, here's a heroic person, here's a handsome person, here is the most talented person in Israel, and he's a person of tremendous modesty. He has no arrogance in him when he assumes the office. He has no ego, which is the perfect person to have as a king. And he's destroyed by the job. Becoming the king is his undoing. He's unable to deal with it. The Medrash tells us in one of its most pithy statements, it tells us that it puts words in God's mouth, so to speak, that God told David, listen, if Shaul had your mazel, he said he could destroy 100 of you. A 100 of you don't come to equal Shaul. It's just that Shaul has no mazel. You have mazel. David has mazel. So even whatever David does wrong, God forgives him. He gets away with it. And Shaul has no mazel, that even if he does one thing wrong, that's his undoing already. He can never recover from it. Shaul is the epitome of self-sacrifice. The Talmud tells us that Shaul gave his fortune away to poor people. And Shaul was the one that had the mitzvah achnosas kala. Poor Jewish girls, he would buy for them their clothing and make their weddings for them. And Shaul went around, he needed nothing. He went around as though he were a poor person. He needed no luxury in life. Everything that he had, he gave to others. And not only that, when he went to war, he paid the soldiers out of his treasury. He didn't pay them out of the public fund. He sacrificed himself and his sons. He went to war with the Philistines, after he had had the prophecy saying that he would not be successful and he would be killed. So a lesser person would have turned away, or any other person would have turned away after such a prophecy. But his loyalty and self-sacrifice for the Jewish people were such that he went almost joyously to his death, he and his sons, because of the fact that he was all for the Jewish people. And all of these traits only compound the tragedy. Scholl supported and enhanced the school system that Shmuel established, so that during his time, level of education among the children of the Jewish people reached a very, very high point. But the Talmud tells us and the Tanakh tells us of his weaknesses. And they're all human weaknesses, and they're all weaknesses that come because of power. His first weakness is that he was too influenced by public opinion. When the prophet Samuel told him that he should destroy Amalek and destroy all the cattle, so Scholl did not do so. He let the cattle live. And he admitted to Shmuel, he said, "Ki yoreisi asom, I was afraid of the people. The people came and said, why should we destroy good cattle, right? Each one of us can have the sheep for ourselves." Scholl wanted to be popular. Let's phrase it in that fashion. He wanted the people to like him. The problem in leadership is that many times you have to do things that are not popular. The task of a leader is not to do what the people want, it's to do what is correct and somehow convince the people to follow him. There's a great difference. All politicians, unfortunately, in our country, most politicians in the world, so they tell the people what they want to hear. If you play back all the campaign promises, it's not worth anything. It's all baloney. Everybody's going to cut your taxes and provide jobs and economy. Everything's going to be terrific. But how does that happen? And it's interesting that we all know it's not true, but we like to hear it. And if somebody tells us the truth, we don't want him. We just don't want him. So Scholl gave in to the popularity bug. "Ki yoreisi asom, I'm afraid of the people." Oh, that's a weakness. That's a terrible weakness in governing. It's a terrible weakness in being the king. The king has to set the example. The king can't be afraid. The Talmud extends that to the rabbis and to any person of leadership, and says that a rabbi that is universally popular in his community, it's a sign that he's not doing the job. Everybody likes him. Nobody has a bad word. So almost all of us don't suffer from that problem. But a rabbi that's universally popular, the Talmud says, so he's not doing the job. If you saw Salanter and his famous quip added, he said, a rabbi that the people don't want to get rid of, so he's not a rabbi. But a rabbi that allows the people to get rid of him is a nitken mensch. Right? Then he's not a, then there's something else wrong with him. And that's the tightrope. That's the narrow line. You cannot be too antagonistic. You can't be the only one and leave the flock behind that they don't follow you at all. On the other hand, you can't be too popular and do exactly what they want, because then that's not your role. That's not the role of leadership. The second problem that we see in Scholl was insecurity, jealousy, paranoia, which eventually reflects itself almost in mental illness. He becomes moody, melancholy. He sees traitors. He takes David HaMelech, who is his trusted aide and confidant and his son-in-law, and who can wait to be the king until Shaul lives a long and productive life. And he listens to slander about him. He imputes the worst of motives to him. He makes him his blood enemy. And no matter how many times he reconciles with him, as he does, after every reconciliation, it begins to gnaw at him again and again and again, the insecurity, the paranoia. He hears the Lashon Hara of his advisors, especially of Doeg HaAdomi, who is an enemy of David, and he is unable to resist it. And therefore he destroys himself, he destroys his daughter's life, he almost destroys David's life, and he almost destroys the Jewish people. The man that sacrifices everything for the Jewish people, and is so selfless, but now his insecurities, his ego, gets in the way to such an extent that it endangers the entire thing. Shaul was the one that mobilized an army. He's the great warrior in his 2 years of being the king, really in the 3 years, 1 year together with Shmuel, and the 2 years afterwards. He is able to free the Jewish people of all of their enemies with the exception of the Philistines. And he attempts in one last great battle before his death to defeat the Philistines, and he is killed and his sons are killed. And it will remain for David to continue, and David is the one that eventually triumphs over the Plishtim and destroys them. But Shaul's army is the basis. Shaul lays the foundation for the military victory. And the military victory is what unites the country, what puts it together. For once, there are safe and secure borders. For once, they're not at war. And I mentioned to you, we saw when we studied regarding the prophets, that it was only during the reign of Dvorah that there was 40 years of peace. And the whole 400 years, 90% of the time, they're at war. Which is also, it's a depressing thing to think about, but it's a realistic thing. Jewish people never enjoyed a moment's peace in their land. Not for long, long periods of time. And Shaul is able to do it. Our rabbis also say a third point about Shaul, which will conclude the character sketch. Shaul is a person of extremes. Emotional person of extremes. And our rabbis always said that you have to be careful of such people. Today he's extremely good and kind, tomorrow he's extremely bad and cruel. The rabbis that phrase it in their inimitable fashion, that when he left Amalek to live, so a baskol, a voice came out of him of heaven and said, "Al tizdak harbe, don't be such a tzaddik, too much of a tzaddik. I told you to kill them, I told you to get rid of them, because you left Agog alive, so then there'll be Haman and there'll be Hitler and they'll leave. All of it is still going to go on. You had a chance to end it now. But you are a bigger tzaddik than I am," God says. Right? You're more liberal. You're the ACLU. You're in favor of, you're against the death penalty under all circumstances, even the worst of persons. You don't want to listen to what I say. Al tizdak harbe. Don't be too much of a tzaddik, Shaul. Too much of a tzaddik is also bad. I used to have a Rebbe, one of his great statements, people used to ask him, is he frum? So he used to say, frum is a galach. Priest is frum. Goy is frum. We don't have anything frum. The frum is, either you do what's in the book, you don't do what's in the book. That's the only measure. But pious more than the book. That's a dangerous, dangerous thing. To be a bigger tzaddik than God, that's a very, very dangerous thing. And then we see the opposite reaction, that when the city, when Nov Ir HaKohanim, the city of Nov, so the Kohen that was in Nov, Achimelech, supplied David unknowingly, but he supplied David with bread and he gave him a sword, and he didn't know that David was fleeing from the king. So when Shaul found out about it, his rage was so great, his jealousy was so great, that he killed out the city of Nov, all the Kohanim, he killed them. So then the Basko came from heaven and said, Al Tirsha Harbe, don't be too big a Russia. What did they do to you? They didn't mean any act of disloyalty. They had no intention to harm anyone. How did you do such a thing? The blood of so many innocent people on your hands. Al Tirsha Harbe, don't be such a Russia. Well, those two extremities, the rabbis used to characterize the problem of Shaul. Extreme person, emotional person, carried away. Now, if you put those three qualities together, that's the negative side. That's the weakness side. And that weakness side undoes almost all the good that could have been created. Because he becomes obsessed not by the outer problems of the Jewish people, not by the true enemies of the Jewish people, he becomes obsessed by David. He becomes obsessed by his own question of succession. In the comment that he makes to his son, Yehonasan, that he accuses him of favoring David over himself. And Yehonasan and David, who are the best of friends, the example of true friendship that exists in the Tanakh, so Yehonasan is willing to accede to the fact that David should be the king. He sees that David is worthy to be the king. But Shaul is not willing to agree to it. And Shmuel is so frightened of Shaul that he conceals the fact. Shmuel, who is the strong man, and who has always told Shaul in no uncertain terms what God wants, but here Shmuel's afraid to tell him that David is anointed, or that he had any part in it. He hides from him because of the fact that he knows the depths of Shaul's enmity, of his jealousy, of his unreasoning nature in this matter. But Shaul, at the end of his life, as I mentioned, he calls upon Shmuel to save him. He calls him back from the dead. He cannot operate without Shmuel. Can't deal with him. And he can't deal with the situation that Shmuel is gone. So he raises him from the dead. So whether we say, as the Rambam says, that that was a dream that Shaul had, or whether we follow the opinion of most of the traditional Mephorshim, that he did go to this witch in Endor, and that she did raise the spirit of Shmuel from the dead, it makes no difference. The idea is that he cannot go without Shmuel. He cannot exist without him. And even though Shmuel is the man that predicted his demise and told him that the cloak of monarchy would be torn from him, he nevertheless cannot go without having communication with Shmuel. One final insight that the rabbis say, only the rabbis can deal with it, the view of it. Why wasn't Shaul the proper man to be the king? What was the inherent problem? So the Talmud tells us, the Gemara is in Yuma, the problem tells us that you should never appoint a leader that doesn't have a kupo shel shrotzim, that doesn't have a skeleton in his closet. That somebody come up to him and say, you're the Rosh Yeshiva. I remember, I saw you at the movie 20 years ago. Oh, that's good. Now we got the right guy. Oh, you're the guy. Oh, yeah. Didn't I meet you in Vegas? That's not to encourage that behavior, but the rabbis here tell us an important lesson in life. Shim tozuach daito olav, the Gemara says, because if he gets too uppity, if he thinks too much about himself, then somebody comes, hey, you know, I remember you. Nobody could do that with Shaul. Shaul was perfect. Oh, you have a perfect leader, that's terrible. Then it's only going to be trouble. David wasn't perfect, right? David, they said, oh, you know, your grandmother was Ruth, you know, was she Jewish? Yeah, she was. Yeah, it could be. Well, there's a story about her. Well, so that already, you know. So David, you know, you could reach David. Couldn't reach Shaul, Chazal say. Shaul saw himself differently. He had no chink in his armor. He had no chink in his armor, then he fell apart. That's the tragedy of Shaul. Shaul is the great tragic figure in all of Tanakh. There is no more tragic figure than Shaul, because Shaul is what could have been and what wasn't. And the Mephoshim say that's why he was the first king of Israel, because it shows the inherent tragedy of the monarchy. What the monarchy does, what leadership does. And from that we can extrapolate it to all situations in life and to all circumstances and to all cases of national leadership as well.